while on this form is that, like you all, I have a really full inbox. So sometimes I'll get a request that says, like, hey, can you come read to my class next week on Thursday? Which is enough time for me to prepare for that ask, but I might not read that email until Tuesday of the following week, just because sometimes life happens. But if you submit that form, it's a lot easier for me to stay on top of that one submission place, so that I can make sure that I am responding to all of those asks that way. So I'm going to do a better job of steering people to that place this year. It also helps us to really demonstrate the worth of this work. So if I have all of my requests in one place, I can also look and be like, okay, my job is important because look at all of these different things. So that'll be really helpful for me if you all can kind of help me in that space. So without further ado, let's talk about this really cool thing called pronouns. So just to kind of reiterate what I was saying before, this imperative for inclusion is now. Our demographic trends illustrate new and accepting perceptions of gender identity and expression, particularly in our younger generations. I know this isn't news to you all. You see this in your classrooms on a regular basis. But the number of Americans that identify as transgender has doubled in the past 15 years. So people have a lot of different opinions on why that's happening. Some folks think it's because we have more language to actually describe the way that we feel about ourselves. And others feel like we have had an increase in acceptance around this topic, which has created an opportunity for people to openly disclose the way that they identify. Either way, we know the numbers are increasing, regardless of the cause. So I want to kind of just jump right into it and start here with this difference between terminology. So these are two that I hear commonly used to they're often used interchangeably. Thank you. But that's not actually what these words mean. So when we're talking about sex, we're talking about a social, legal, medical designation assigned at birth based on an assessment of the body. So this is one of three things. When a baby is born, whoever delivers that child says, you know, this is a male, this is a female, or this is an intersex child. So when we're talking about sex, we're only talking about those three things. When we're talking about gender, this is where things get more challenging for folks to understand and also can be much more interesting and intricate. So when we're talking about gender, this is the cultural meanings such as masculinity or femininity assigned to biological sexes within a specific historical and geographical way of being. So what I kind of mean by that is there's lots of different ways that we interpret what it means to be someone. Or what it means to be a type of person or a type of, you know, we can talk about learners, right? There's lots of different types of learners. And sometimes we assign what we think somebody might need based off of what we understand a certain type of person to be like. And so the way that we learn to understand gender is very similar. We have this understanding of what it might mean to be called a girl. And as we grow up, we see things that either affirm that understanding or are in direct conflict with it. And then we're kind of left to decide what we're going to do with that information. So gender is a space where there's a lot more information and a lot more things going on, where sex is pretty cut and dry. There are just those three things we're talking about. So I like this gender unicorn because I think it really breaks it down well, and it kind of gives us this reiteration here of this spectrum. So I have that graphic on that last slide. So previously when we talked about gender, a lot of times it was this fixed understanding. So it was an either-or question, and the line that you would place yourself on had really strong fixed ends. What we're continuing to learn as we do more research in this area and are able to really adapt our language to meet us where we're at is that this isn't a fixed spectrum, or I'm sorry, this isn't a fixed line, it is an open spectrum. So when we're identifying ourselves, it can be anywhere along this plane, and we can kind of put things in different spaces. So maybe the way that I feel like I identify today is really high on this female space, but I also have some things that feel like they align with what I understand it means to be a man, right? So I can mark these different places on here. So when we're talking about gender identity, this is how I identify, and some people feel like they're gender assigned at birth, which we often refer to as cisgender, is correct for how they understand themselves, and some people don't. And I'll talk a little bit more about this language here, of this agreement between what you're assigned on a couple different slides later on. So don't worry, I'll talk about that some more. The other piece that I really like here is this gender expression. So this is when we look at these dots over here on the side. So when we're talking about gender expression, this is how I look or express myself the ways in which people externally present their gender through clothing, hairstyle, body shape, and other things. So sometimes for those of us who don't really have to think about what it means to express our gender, some of these topics can be really challenging to understand or to empathize with someone who might be struggling with expressing themselves. For example, when I woke up this morning, I put on this red dress. When I went to my closet, my thought process wasn't, well, I identify as a woman and I really want to express that through my clothing and my hairstyle today, so I think I'm going to wear this dress and these earrings and these shoes. That's not really how that thought process went for me. And a lot of that has to do with coming to work in a dress is considered acceptable. It doesn't challenge anybody's beliefs of what it means to show up as a professional in this space. So I don't have to really take any risks in order to express who I am in a way that's true to how I want to, you know, exist in this space. So I don't really have to put a lot of thought into preparing myself to be in shared spaces with other people. So if my experience was not like that and I wanted to express myself in the way that I felt true as myself, was in conflict with the way people might perceive me or might create a challenge in my, you know, day, either with my family or the people I live with or within my classroom or learning environment, the way I go about expressing my gender might be a lot more challenging experience for me to process through. This other part of this also has to do with access, right? Like, I have different types of clothes that I can put on to express the way that I feel about myself. I know how to style my hair in different types of ways. I feel like my body fits me in a way that really expresses who I am, and I have access to that, right? And if I don't like something or something doesn't feel right, I have an opportunity to change that. So I can buy a different type of clothing. I can change the way my hair looks. Not everybody has that access. So having to continue to be in a space where you have to express yourself in a way that doesn't align with who you are can be a really challenging experience and can completely close off your access to learning. So if I'm going to come and sit in a classroom all day wearing clothes and having my hair in a way that doesn't feel right, it's going to be really challenging for me to access the learning. Like, I might not feel motivated to read a story that day, right? Because I'm having such a hard time just existing in the space that I'm in because it doesn't align with who I know myself to be. So I think that piece is really important to think about when it shows up in our classrooms. The next one here is that sex assigned at birth. So that's what I talked about on that last slide. It's really, this is the only one that's fixed. There's those three things. As we know, you can go and do a surgical procedure to change some of this external, the external ways that your body looks and the way that it functions. You can have different types of hormones that change the way your body is going to look and function. And so that's kind of where that intersects here to this sex assigned at birth place. We do have that assignment of male, female, intersex, or another sex based on a combination of anatomy, hormones, and chromosomes. And as we continue to grow up, we can work with our doctors to kind of change the way that our physiological self is. So there are options there for folks as they are transitioning. The last piece here I thought was important to include in this conversation about gender, because similar to the way that sex and gender are used interchangeably incorrectly, sometimes we bring in this conversation about orientation or attraction into a conversation about gender where it doesn't actually belong. So when we're talking about our attraction or orientation, this is how we feel about other people, our physical attraction or emotional attraction, but it isn't dependent on all of these other things. So what I mean by that is if I tell you that I am a woman, that doesn't mean that you will automatically know who I'm physically or emotionally attracted to. So this is not a predictor. Your gender identity, expression, or sex are not predictors of who you will be attracted to. And even just your gender identity is not necessarily a predictor of your gender expression. So it's important to remember that these things function separately. And in the past, we haven't had as, like, defined of a language, or we haven't all been in this space where we understood how to separate these things. So as we're continuing to learn and grow in this area, it's important to know that some of this might be contradictory to what you might have learned at a different time. But now that we have more language and we have more opportunity to learn about how we understand gender, this is where we're starting to really understand how this works. So the important part to take away from this right here, if you don't hear anything else in this section from me today, is to understand that your identity, expression, your gender, your sexual orientation, these are all separate parts of who you are. And you can't use an identity, that one of these single identities that you know about a student or someone who you're working with, to predict the rest of these things in their identity. It's super important to recognize that these have different parts of who we are, and they can play off one of another as you are expressing yourself, but that isn't a fixed rule. I didn't say this at the beginning, so I'm going to say it now. If you have questions, comments, concerns, cries of outrage as we go along, I can't see all of you at the same time, so you can use that raise hand feature, but if I don't respond, it's not because I'm ignoring you or it's on purpose, I just haven't seen it. So just unmute and be like, "Ayo, Gigi, I got a question," and we'll pause and I'll answer it.
And Gigi, let me just quick add that I find encouraging folks to read more on intersex, because folks understand male, female. That is clear. Now that intersex, it is very important for folks to read and understand that piece. That might help inform some of the questions on transgender and you know, or the question of nurture versus nature and all that stuff. Again, I really encourage folks to start with a simple search of what is intersex, and then progress from there. It's going to really inform a lot of some of those questions that you might have, or even you've not formulated as of this moment. But I really encourage you to read more on intersex.
Awesome. Thanks, Sam. That's definitely something that we can kind of add to our resource bank, too, that you all will get access to in the next month. Awesome. So to keep on cruising through here, I told you I'd come back to this conversation about cisgender and transgender. So normally when I have this conversation, I start off with this group expectation of non-closure. And I love this expectation because it's really helpful, I think, to kind of set the stage. But oh my goodness, is it hard to really put into practice. So when I talk about non-closure, what I really mean is that some of the information that I'm going to share and that we're talking through is going to feel like that's not a full answer, or some of this is contradictory, or some of this feels like I need more information. And a lot of times my response to you is like, yeah, you're probably right. This does feel like maybe we need more information, or this does contradict itself. But this is kind of just where we're at with this information. And this can be especially challenging when we're talking about the English language, because our language is a tool that we use as humans to communicate with one another. And we are the ones who manipulate that tool to fit the way that we would like to communicate. And sometimes I think we forget that, and we really like focus on this language as the one that has the ownership of us and our storytelling. But we are the ones who create this language. And if you look at the evolution of our language over time, it has continued to grow and develop and stay relevant to the way that we are continuing to use it. So some of these words that we use now, if we look at their origin, like the Latin roots of these words, the way that we use them doesn't exactly align with those original roots. So I think it's important to know that so that you can kind of have that understanding as we move into this conversation some more. So when we talk about cisgender, that is someone who is assigned a sex and a gender at birth, and as they continue to grow up, that gender is something that aligns or affirms who they are as a person. So I identify as a cisgender person, and when I was born, they said, "It's a girl," and every day since then, I said, "Yep, that was correct." So I identify as cisgender. And so sometimes when we talk about same side, that's what people will say, because that's what that cis root of that word means. And when we're talking about trans, when we look at the root, we hear opposite. And this is where that contradiction happens. Because if you remember on that slide with the gender unicorn, I talked about how we're not functioning on that fixed binary system where it's an either or. We recognize that that system opens up and it's actually a spectrum of identity. So when we talk about trans, sometimes when we look at that root, that opposite piece can feel really challenging to understand. And sometimes people still slip into that pattern and talk about an opposite gender or an opposite sex, when that's not actually true. It's like if I told you I have a number scale of 1 to 5 and I asked you, what's the opposite of 2? Like, well, there's there's not an opposite of 2. There's a long scale of numbers, right? And I know there's a math person here who's ready to challenge me, and I promise you I will fail. I don't know math very well. It's just a random example I pulled. Please don't come for me. But what I'm really trying to demonstrate here is that it's important to recognize that some of the roots of the word don't align with the way that we use them, and that is okay. So cisgender is when we're talking about someone who aligns with that identity that they were given at birth, and trans is someone who does not align with the identity they were given at birth and has a new identity that makes the most sense for who they are. So that identity that somebody else gave them did not fit, so they were able to find an identity that fit them correctly. So there's a lot of different terms that our students use, that some of our staff members use, that describe this. This list does not include all of the terms. When I first presented some of this information to students, I gave them a list very similar to this, and they added like 15 words on there, right? So this is a space where that non-closure is also really important to keep in mind. This is something that we're continuing to grow in our language, and as we continue to grow through it, there are going to be new words. Some of them are going to phase out, and we're going to find the best way to really represent this group in our language. So the one that I hear the most frequently is non-binary. So this is a gender identity which falls outside of the gender binary, meaning an individual does not identify strictly as female or male. A non-binary person can identify as both or neither, and sometimes one or the other. So this is an identity that has a lot of flexibility for someone to identify. And I think it's kind of important just to highlight that one, because you hear that, I think, the most often.
JJ?
Yeah, what you got?
What restroom does a non-binary person use?
Say that one more time.
What restroom does a non-binary person use?
It's a great question. So that would be up to the individual. So, like, similar to, like, how this definition here says, a non-binary person can identify as both, either somewhere in the middle. So the place that that person is going to feel most comfortable is going to be the restroom that they're going to use. This is why we're starting to see more schools have those single-stall restrooms, because it does kind of pull that challenge off the table, and it provides that safe space for people who might not feel like they fit in that binary decision. Good question.
Gigi?
Yeah, what you got?
Could you also explain what furries are?
I can talk about furries. So oftentimes that's brought up in this conversation, and that's not actually part of a gender identity. So a furry identity, or a way that somebody might, sometimes it's called like a fursona. I did a lot of research on this, because I got a lot of questions around this year, is something that somebody might, like they feel a connection to, they feel an identity with, and it shifts the way that they want to express themselves. So similar to the way that we were talking about gender expression, except that it's not related to their gender or their understanding of who they are as a person, but it is related to their identity and how they express themselves. So when we talk about furries, it does not fit into the same category of gender. But it does fit into a category of identity expression, right? And so when we see the conversation of furries happening in schools, it's really important just to tie back to that dress code, because we do have some pretty strict rules around what kind of clothing you can wear to school and whether or not that can include, you know, something like a tail or ears, or like if kids can wear headbands that have ears on them, right? So if a kid wants to wear that to school and it fits in the dress code, then that's just fine. And just like anything else, if it starts to create a disruption of learning and it isn't something that can be addressed appropriately in the classroom, that's where we start to see those issues. But otherwise, if someone wants to express their identity by the, you know, clothing, that is something that we support in a lot of different places for the way that our students express themselves.
Is it true that they were using litter boxes instead of regular bathrooms?
No, that is not true.
No, that is not true, and I was going to add about bathrooms and saying we are actively working to make sure that our district buildings all have gender-neutral bathrooms, or family bathrooms, as I like to call them, to take care of the challenge of what bathroom people use. So that is an active work that we're doing, working with our grounds department, grounds crew, and to make sure that we have more bathrooms. But I must say, though, the district has made a lot of strides. A lot of the schools have been working towards that for the past 2 years. A lot of the buildings that saw renovations, did some work around that. PJs, Fash, they've done some good work already around that. So it's a work in progress. But no litter boxes, that is enough. Yeah. No, we didn't do that.
All right, so here is the next step of this. So now that we've talked a little bit about what gender identity is, I want to talk about pronouns. So when we talk about pronouns, this is a placeholder for your name and your identity. And there's lots of different terms that people have started using. I pulled this chart from UW-Milwaukee Center for Inclusion, and this is the list that they have that they've seen students using interchangeably. So I wanted to include this not to go through and give you a step-by-step how each of these are used. That will be included in your resource packet because I don't think that's the best use of our short time that we have left with us today. But I do think it's important to see that there are different types of pronouns that people can use. So sometimes if a student brings something to you, and I've gotten some really helpful emails from folks this year, those like, hey, Gigi, I had a student who came in today and they're using this pronoun. Is this a thing? And I love getting those questions because people are trying to figure out how to best support a student. So some of these pronouns I've never seen used before, and so it was new for me to learn how to use them. So if you're having that feeling too, I put this on the slide just to kind of affirm you and knowing that some of this feels new even for those of us who do this work all of the time. So this is part of being present in the times that are shifting, right? So we're starting to see this new use of our language, and so it can feel really different or challenging to stay with it or understand what's happening because it's being created as we're living in it. So sometimes that can feel really intense. So I think it's important here to also note to avoid the phrase preferred pronouns. So this implies that the use of a pronoun is optional versus a requirement. So you just want to say pronouns, because that's what they are. My name is Gigi Stahl. I use she, her, and her pronouns. That isn't a preference. That's who I am. And I need you to use those terms to really value who I am and speak to me correctly. If you were to come into this space and be like, oh, hey, Gigi, he's that guy over there, I wouldn't feel like you were truly saying who I am or understanding what I bring to the table. So it's important to use those correct pronouns just like you would use a correct name. If I'm trying to build a strong relationship with Sam, but I keep calling him Tim, he's not going to feel like I truly care about who he is, and he's not really going to want to build a strong relationship with me because I can't even bother to call him by the right name, right? So it's important to understand this. Another place that we commonly see gendered terminology is in our names as, like, teachers in a room. So if I were to use, like, a prefix for my name, I would say, like, I'm Miss Gigi, right? So that prefix is also gendered. We have a fixed understanding of what it means to use Miss versus Mrs. versus Mr., right? And so we have that understanding of what that means. And if I were to call, you know, Sam Mrs. Dinga, that would be referring to somebody else, right? That's not his name. That's incorrect. So, like, if your students were to use, you know, call you Mrs. instead of Mr. or, you know, Miss instead of Mrs., that has a different understanding of who you are as a person. And I think it's kind of helpful to use that tie-in to understand what it means to use an incorrect pronoun, which we'll talk about on camera if it's next slide or the next slide. So the next slide. So I think on this next slide, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the how. You know, I've kind of talked about what is this gender, what is gender, how can we understand how it works, what are pronouns, and now I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what to actually do with this. So on the next slide, we're really going to talk about what to do when you make a mistake, because it's not an if, it's when. It's going to happen. But I think it's important to pause here just to take a moment to recognize what happens if you actually ignore a pronoun that's being asked of you to use appropriately. And I use appropriately because I'm not talking about a situation where you don't know somebody's pronoun and you've asked and maybe it's changed since the last time you talked to them and now you're using something that's incorrect and you're being corrected. I'm not talking about those moments where you've done the due diligence to make sure you're, you know, referring to someone using the correct terminology and you've made a mistake because something has changed. I'm talking about if I told you my name is Gigi, I use she, her pronouns, and you say, I'm not going to use those. I think that I'm going to use he him and his pronouns for you instead. I'm talking about those kinds of situations. So when you're doing that, what you're communicating is that you know students better than they know themselves. Their sense of safety is not important to you. You want to teach all of their peers and all of the other teachers around them to disrespect them. You can hear them talking, you're not really listening, and you would prefer if they stop being honest with you. Because I know what it's like to be in classrooms with teachers, I know these are not the things that you are trying to do to students. So I think it's important to understand that the impact of what some of these decisions to not use the correct gender to talk to students really has on them. And although that might not align with your intentions, it doesn't change the fact that this can be a really harmful experience for a student. So back on that gender unicorn page, I was talking about gender expression and how, like, if I don't feel like I can express who I truly am and I have to sit in a space that isn't true to myself, it can be a barrier to my learning. So this works in that same kind of way. If I'm entering a classroom where I know that my sense of safety is not important to my teacher, it's going to be really hard for me to be available to learn in that space. So learning about a student's pronouns and really showing up to in that space isn't just about creating an inclusive space in your classroom. It's also about ensuring that your students are able to learn what you're going to be teaching them. So when you make mistakes, it's important to just kind of do what's in this picture here. So the first one you want to do, you want to acknowledge that you did something, you messed up, apologize, correct yourself, and move on. Then if there's feedback that's offered to you, you can accept it, and then take some time later on to self-reflect. What I see most often is that we really skip this number four step. So when we make a mistake, we say like, she mentioned, sorry, they mentioned, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. It's so hard for me to use this new pronoun. I don't have any practice using they. I don't really understand how it works, and it's super hard for me, and I just don't know what to do, so I'm really sorry, right? And so it turns into this conversation that's now about me instead of really focusing on whatever that conversation was about. So it's really important in those moments to move on. And if you do need some additional support or you don't quite understand how something works, that's a great opportunity to reach out to somebody like me or somebody in your building who you feel comfortable having that discussion with so that you can have a little bit more information to support you in that new thing that you're trying. But that moving on thing, especially directly in that moment, is super important. Sometimes the feedback that we're offered, especially when it comes from, kids who aren't as used to using their language to express their feelings yet, even though those of us as adults still need some more practice using language to express our feelings too, sometimes that feedback that we can get can feel really personal, it can feel really hard, and it's important to remember that if someone is giving us feedback, it means that they actually care about what we are doing, right? So if I'm in a space where you're saying something that hurts me, but I don't actually really care about continuing to build a relationship with you, I'm not going to offer you any feedback because I'm not actually looking to strengthen the connection between the two of us, so I don't really need you to know how to care about me better. But if you're using a term to, you know, address me incorrectly and I'm telling you like, hey, that's actually wrong, I need you to use this instead, it means that I'm, you know, putting out a bid for connection. And I'm saying, I would like to connect with you better. I would like you to see me better. I would like you to understand who I truly am. And in order to do that, I need you to have this correct information so that you can talk about me. And sometimes it can be really hard when you're receiving a feedback to read that part of it. So I'm hoping that I can just kind of plant this seed with you today in hopes that you can remember that in the challenging situations when you might be receiving feedback that feels really uncomfortable. So the last big takeaway of this is we do have this thing within our school district called a gender support plan. So when students come into the classroom and they say, can you call me this name? Most best practice teachers who are doing a really great job say, cool, that sounds like a great name. I'm going to make sure to call you that. If it seems like it's something that's a little bit more complicated, or a kid is, you know, like this last one says, changes their name or pronouns frequently or is asking for a new name, that's a great opportunity to kind of check in with that kid and be like, hey, are you okay? It's like I'm hearing that you're asking to be called something different. and just have that opportunity to check in with that relationship first. That's that social emotional learning piece, right? Like, how can I'm noticing some changes in your behavior. I'm noticing some changes in your expression. And I just want to check in and make sure that you have the support that you need. And that's one of those moments that it's really important to recognize what kind of support can you provide. Because a lot of times, this is a great time to refer a student to the psychologist in the building, to the school social worker, or to a counselor, someone who has the time that they can sit, you know, one-on-one with the student and make sure that they are, you know, getting the support that they need, that they're safe, and that they have an understanding of what they're experiencing. So that's a really important piece in this part. This is often where I get a lot of questions like, well, what do I do, Gigi, in a complicated situation where, you know, the student is asking me to call them. That's one thing. Their parent is saying, absolutely, under no circumstances will you call my child this. These are a lot more complicated situations, and those are the things that you don't do by yourself. That is when you're working with your building principal, you're working with your social workers and your school psychologist, you're talking to Sam and myself, so that we can be in on those individualized situations and make sure that we're providing the best support for that student, for you as their teacher, and connecting with those families. I intentionally didn't put like a task list in this presentation to say, in that situation, do this, 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 and this. Because there really isn't just one universal perfect solution that works for every single kid. These are things that are really important to pay close attention to and use your team to make sure that we're providing the best support. So if you feel like you're in a situation where you don't know how to respond or you don't feel like you know the best pathway forward, that's a great indicator to reach out to your team and find someone who can support you through it. Because we will do the best we can to work together to find what's best for our students. Which kind of builds into that non-closure idea, right? Like, that's a really sucky answer. The best thing to do is, like, ask for help and figure it out. There isn't just a, like, this is the best thing to do, copy and paste. I wish I had that answer for you, but there aren't always situations where one answer will be the best thing to do. So, what questions do you have about gender and gender identity in our crash course, Pronouns 101, sit and get? I was going to call it a workshop, but it really is more of a sit and get in this format. All right, if you continue to have questions, feel free to reach out. I'm going to move on to this last section for our day. Ooh, I do see a couple now. Okay, so what control do parents have? So since we do have students who are minors, parents have a lot of control. So they can come into a classroom and talk to us about how they want their child to be addressed. And then there's the things that we can control, right? Like, I can't control every single interaction that happens between, you know, children all day. You all know that better than I do. So there's some things that we can have influence over, or, you know, we can, you know, try and shift the way a space functions, but we don't always have control over every single interaction. So if a parent comes in and talks to us about how they want their child to be addressed a certain kind of way, that's where we have a really important conversation with that child, to really talk to them about, like, this is what it means to have a guardian who has authority and rights over you, right? And so let's figure out how to take the best care of you in this situation. So how can, and that's why it's really, really important to partner with those social workers, partner with the school psychologists and your building principals, so that they can walk through that step by step. Good question. I saw a hand raised, but I don't know what happened to it. So if you had your hand raised. Our district decided we're teaching about gender identity in 5th and 6th grade. Chris, are you still in here? I'll take that as no. Okay, so...
That's really funny, Gigi, because literally, like, as you asked that question, I came back in.
Oh, perfect. Welcome back, Chris. So somebody asked the question in the chat of, has our district decided if we're teaching about gender identity in 5th and 6th grade? I know there was some pushback from parents last year, so I wanted to check. I was going to defer to you.
Sure. And I can provide a response to the question. So there is, we are in the process of bringing together our Human Growth and Development Committee, Advisory Committee. The first Advisory Committee meeting is scheduled for September 22nd from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. That's in alignment with Statute 119.018. We have some very specific ratios that we need to adhere to in terms of who sits as a member of that advisory committee. So once we have reviewed both the Human Growth and Development Standards and we've aligned that with the tools and resources that we're using to develop and teach our curriculum, we will have a more definitive answer to that. So at this exact moment in time, the answer is we are continuing with what we have until we get additional feedback from the advisory committee, which will begin on September 22nd. We are hoping that we'll have the September meeting, an October meeting, and a November meeting, and that we'll be able to bring that approved curriculum back to the board for approval in December. Great question.
Thanks, Chris.
Yep.
So I have another question in here that says, what about students refusing to use another student's preferred pronouns? So that's another great time to kind of sit down and have conversations with students again. If this becomes disruptive to the learning environment, this is a great time for some pull-out instruction to have a conversation with this student about how we're going to refer to other people correctly and use their correct name. And, you know, this is another individualized situation. So if you want to work with this student to figure out a pathway forward, like if they're in a situation where they're saying, like, this doesn't align with my belief system, then let's say, okay, well, part of our expectation in our building is to respect other students. And part of the way that we respect other people is by calling them by the correct name. So let's figure out what we can do that feels like it's the right thing in your position to refer to other students in our classroom respectfully. And again, that's another one of those individualized situations where we can work with that student to find a great way to really, you know, include them back in that space so that they can respect other people. There's a question here for you, Chris, too, about whether or not the committee members have been determined.
Yes, I'm typing a response to Leanne right
now.
Oh,
cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Awesome. So then the question of, has the district considered offering safe trainings as a PD option? So yes and. I think that would be a great option, and we haven't really done a lot about securing that as a pathway forward for this year, but I think that would be a really great thing for you to include in my exit survey that you would like to see, if that's something that you're hoping that we're going to offer, so that as I'm starting to build things for the rest of the year, I can make sure to include that. Oh, I see the questions about how to pronounce. So I have seen a couple of questions come through about how to pronounce things. For the sake of time today, I don't want to go through the pronunciation because we still have one more mini workshop session to go through. But I will make sure that when I send you out the resources after this, that it includes links to pronunciation, because I want to make sure that that question is answered. I'm making a note for myself real quick. All right, if you continue to have questions, feel free to ask me, and I will make sure to get them answered for you, but I am going to pivot to this last section so that I can make sure to get this done on time. So, now to talk about racism. So, I don't know why I said that so excited. What I'm really going to start with us today is defensiveness as a tool for change. So, the reason I decided to talk about racism with you all today is, well, similar to gender, the two biggest requests that I got this last year were opportunities for me to either coach students or staff on addressing gender or addressing racism. And a lot of what I heard in the conversation about racism was that students were making accusations of their teachers or their peers, and really just like using racist or racism as like a buzzword almost to kind of like push people's buttons, right? And so I think what's important to recognize in that is that, you know, students in the classroom are very perceptive. And when they can recognize that there's a button that they can push, sometimes they're just going to push it. I was absolutely this student. If I knew I could push a button on my teacher and it meant that I wasn't going to have to learn the lesson that day because they were going to go, you know, and talk about this other thing, I was going to push that button all day long. I didn't want to do anything, right? So I think it's important for us to kind of recognize and do that self-work on our side of, like, what is a button that, you know, what is a topic, what is a situation that I could be in a classroom that is going to make me feel really uncomfortable or is going to make me feel defensive? Because our students can read that in us even if we're not aware of it. So as I kind of start this conversation about racism today, that's kind of where it's going to start out with, is in this space of defensiveness. So some of you all might have seen, like, these magic eye type of graphics where if you look at it for long enough, you know, this one over here on the right will start to look like it's moving. Or this picture on the left, you can see there's faces here, but there's also a tree. And sometimes when we have conversations about racism or oppression, what ends up happening is that those of us who can see the faces in this tree then start to kind of, like, speak poorly about the people who can't see the faces, you know? Or we start to pass this judgment on, like, what do you mean you look at this and you only see a tree? Obviously, there's faces, right? So I think sometimes it's important to remember that at some point, you might have looked at this graphic and not been able to recognize the tree or not have been able to recognize the faces. Or you might look at this and only see fixed lines, right? Maybe you aren't able to see it moving. And remember that everybody has to start somewhere. And some of the challenge that comes with an equity, diversity, and inclusion is this perception that there's people who understand what racism or oppression is, and they're standing there like this and pointing at everybody else and saying, well, I understand racism, so you're the problem, right? And that's not what this work is, and that is not best practice. That is not how I would like anybody to move forward after this conversation today. I think it's really important for us to honor where we're at in our own progress of learning ourselves and the people around us, and recognize that everybody's going to be at a different place, and it isn't our job to shame people for where they're at in their learning. But it is our job to make sure to hold each other accountable so that if it's really important to the understanding of this lesson that you see this face, that I make sure that you have every opportunity to do so. Or if it's really important to me that we all understand that there's a tree right here in the middle, that everybody has that opportunity. So I think it's important just to remember that this isn't about pointing fingers and saying that someone is doing something bad or someone isn't a good person. This is about learning what this tool of racism looks like and how it intersects with our instruction in K-12 and what we can do about it. So this idea of the racism paradox, sorry, this graphic makes me laugh. There's nothing funny about what I'm saying. I'm pulling up my notes. Please hold. I didn't have it up on the right screen and it disappeared. Na-na-na-na-na. Theme music while I find the right slide. Okay. So sometimes when we're talking about racism, some of the definitions can create conflict in what we're trying to express, which kind of creates this paradox of saying, like, well, this is racist. Well, no, this is racist. And it's like, wait a minute, what are we really trying to say here? And what is, you know, what is really happening? And that's kind of where that paradox creates itself. And we see this with our students, where someone will say that something is racist, and somebody will say, well, no, it isn't. And then it kind of creates this conflict in the conversation. And so that's where I want to be able to give you all some tools to kind of navigate, is how to build yourself out of this conflict. So the first thing I want to say is, if a marginalized person is speaking to their experience and you feel uncomfortable, sit with it. Let that discomfort be productive. Don't try to get away from it. That discomfort is teaching you something about your own positionality and potentially some areas that you might not be able to see. And you want to make sure to listen to that. So what I mean by that is, if there's a situation where a student is expressing that something feels racist to them in their experience, sometimes because we love our schools and we love the work that we're doing, our first response is like, well, no, it's not. It's not racist. And that's what we want. That's what we want to communicate. And if we look, you know, pulling in that social emotional learning again, if we look underneath that behavior, what we're really trying to say is, I believe in this school. I believe in this work, and I know that it has intentions to be good. That is what we are trying to communicate. But if we look under that message from our students, what they're saying is like, what I'm experiencing here doesn't feel good to me, right? And we need to be able to hear that piece. And sometimes that's uncomfortable. And in this work, like, it's important for me to know that, right? So if I want to be a good educator and I want to work in this system, it's important for me to be able to look way back to the beginning of our conversation today and see that I live in a state that performs the worst for Black students, right? So I live in a state where that is happening. And if I don't, if I'm not willing to acknowledge that, it's going to be really hard for me to do anything about changing it. So being defensive about whether or not the system serves Black children doesn't actually help anybody, right? But being able to recognize that there are some areas for us to grow and or to grow and be able to sit in that discomfort can actually be really fruitful and provide me an opportunity to learn better and serve my students better. So I want you all to kind of participate with this one in the chat. I want you to tell me, what is the best movie you have ever seen in the theater? I need a couple answers here. Ooh, dang. Okay, now they're taking off. All right, so I hate to break it to you, but all of those movies suck. They're the worst movies that have ever been created in the history of time, and they are all just terrible. So I hate to break it to you all right now. Those are just really bad movies. So what I want to kind of build from this is, I won't just talk, that would be really good. Okay, so I think it's really important to kind of pull into this idea of, like, you don't want to yuck somebody's yum, right? So if I'm, I hear that in elementaries a lot, but if I'm teaching a class and I say, tell me about your favorite thing, and then I look at this and see, there's lots of Lord of the Rings, which honestly I really appreciate, but if my response to that is like, well, Lord of the Rings sucks. And honestly, it's the stupidest movie I've ever heard of. I would not recommend it to anybody, and you're probably not as cool as I thought you were because you like that movie. That's not going to make you feel encouraged to participate in my class the rest of the day, right? Because I just said, you just gave me this thing that you really like, and I said, right? That is not a good feeling. And so when our students are talking about experiencing racism in our schools, sometimes it's something that feels just as simple as this, where they're disclosing something in the classroom, they're expressing a need, and our response isn't explicitly, well, that sucks, but that's what it feels like to our students. So to kind of break this down more specifically, sometimes the movies that we pick are related to our personal experience. So if I put us all in a movie theater right now and we watch Sam Dingus' childhood slideshow, that might not be my favorite movie, right? There might be some things in there that I really don't understand. They don't mean anything to me. And so I might walk out of the theater, like, feeling like my life has not changed or feeling like it wasn't really important, right? But Sam's probably going to sit there watching this movie and really be, like, fully engaged in it, be really reminiscing. He's going to be laughing, full of lots of different emotions, right? Because this film is directly related to his personal experience. Similarly, if we're in there and we are watching, let's pick one of these movies, The Princess Bride, elite choice, by the way, but if I'm in the movie theater watching Princess Bride and my ticket puts me right behind a pillar, I might walk out of this movie and say, like, this was the worst movie ever, this theater sucks, I couldn't even see the film, like, the voices sounded super weird, you know, because then my whole experience of the film is going to be different, because I can't see anything, I can only just hear the movie. So that's going to change the way that I understand what happened, it's going to change the way that I might feel like something is good or not, like, the value I have of that experience will be different, because my view has been obstructed. Same thing as if we're showing this film, let's pick another one. We're going to do Top Gun, but only 20 tickets. So out of the 238 of you in this room, only 20 of you get to go, right? So that's going to change your experience, because those of you who are in that 20 group might feel really special and really excited that you got to go see this film, right? But all, you know, 218 of the rest of us are going to be like, man, what makes them so special? Why did they get to go see this film? And so that's going to change the way we understand the value of that film or the way that we understand what it's really about because we didn't get to see it. And there was a limited, you know, amount of people who were allowed to have that experience. And then there's this one. If I go to the movie and this time I'm going to go see Thor and a tornado hits the theater, I'm probably going to have a little bit different experience and have a different understanding of what that film was than someone who watched it in a theater, wasn't hit by a tornado, right? So the way that we go about experiencing something changes the way that we feel about it, the way we understand it, and the way we value it. So even though we can provide this one thing that might be exactly the same for everybody, how our students show up to meet it and experience it could be very different. And some of that could have something to do with the way that we're presenting it in our classroom, and some of it might have something to do with the way they've experienced it elsewhere. For example, if I'm showing the movie Thor, and the kids in my classroom have only seen it that one time that they got hit by a tornado when they saw it, they're probably going to meet that lesson a little bit different than the kids who have had really positive experiences with this film or have never seen it before, right? So knowing how your perception or your view of your experience can be impacted is a really important part of understanding what is underneath that expression of the student saying, this is racist. So when we're hearing a student express that, I want you to try and listen for these four filters. So is this student talking about safety? So when we're thinking about this, you know, kind of metaphor that I built here with the tornado, or I'm sorry, with the different versions of the film, so is this student talking about a situation where the tornado hit a deer? So are they expressing something that they might be saying, like, this is racist, but if you look underneath it, we're hearing, I don't feel safe here, or I don't feel like there's someone that I can talk to. Because a lot of times, especially with our younger students, they don't have access to language to describe what they're feeling, right? So they're going to show it by the way that they, like, feel really big things, right? Maybe they're throwing something or they're hitting somebody or they're running away, and they're trying to communicate something that they don't have the language to talk about. So I want you to look for that. Are they communicating about their safety? The other one is bias. So that's when we're talking about that childhood slideshow, right? So like if I show a film or I show something in my classroom that feels really relevant to me and feels like it's really important, is that because of my bias and what I am bringing into the space? And this lesson really resonates well with me because of who I am. Or this lesson resonated really well with this group of kids. Why would this other group of kids not feel like they're represented, right? So that's what we're looking for. What is the lens that I'm bringing to this lesson, to this interaction, to this behavior intervention that is going to change the way that I'm interpreting what's being communicated to me? So really taking into consideration, is a student expressing that they're feeling something that is maybe biased or hasn't been really considered for how it might impact someone with a different perception or experience? The next one here is access. So that's when we're talking about only 20 tickets. So sometimes, like for example, I was doing a presentation and the infamous Jamie Granger did a really great job of offering me some correction. So I was talking and reading a book about students who lived in an apartment. And she took a moment to talk to me and really, you know, tried to express that there's students who don't know what that's like. They've never lived in an apartment. So if you're trying to use this as a foundation for the learning that's going to follow, you're going to lose a lot of students because they don't have access to that relation. They don't have the lived experience to know what it's like. And if your outcome for this learning is dependent on that, you're not going to be able to teach these kids the lesson you're trying to learn, right? And so I was really grateful for that because I was able to then adapt my lesson so that there was access. You know, I had more than 20 tickets available for the show I was putting on. I made sure that there wasn't that learning barrier so that our students could relate to the material that I was bringing, which I think is pretty good. This last one is that equity piece, right? So I'm pulling out my slide. So we talked about the tornado hitting the theater, the 20 tickets, and then the obstructed view. So when we're talking about equity, that's when we're talking about that obstructed view. So when I'm providing content in the classroom, or I'm teaching a lesson, or I'm, you know, responding to a behavior incident, how am I making sure that my view isn't obstructed, right? So I think behavior is a really great example of this. So if a kid is coming and reporting a story to me, right, and I'm just listening to this kid, and I know they're a really trustworthy kid, they're a really good kid, but they're in this situation with conflict, right? And so they're telling me what's going on, and I'm like, okay, I hear that there's a bullying incident and somebody was picking on you, and I know that you're a good kid, so I'm going to listen to this other kid's story. And maybe I've seen this other kid in the office more frequently, so I have a perception of how this kid behaves. And I think that they probably get into trouble more often than the other kid. So when I'm listening to them tell their story, I'm like, yeah, I think you were the instigator here. And this situation is probably because you were misbehaving, because I know that you have a pattern of this misbehavior, right? So if I'm allowing my obstructed view or an assumption that I have about this kid's behavior or a bias that I have built off of, you know, things that they've done in the past, that might create a situation where I'm not truly seeing what's actually happening. And sometimes that is really what's happening, right? But it's our job to make sure that we're removing the barriers and we're giving kids that fair shot, and we're making sure we're hearing what they're saying, and we're making sure that we're meeting their needs, you know, exactly where they're at, so that they're feeling heard and we're not obstructing that view. And sometimes it can feel really challenging to kind of work through these things, because we're not always used to looking underneath, you know, an information that's being communicated with us to see what's being communicated, especially if we're not in the habit of doing that. And an example I kind of want to share with that is my lovely friend Haley from undergrad. So this is me in college. We really liked this transformation photo, which I thought was really helpful for the transformation that I want to kind of talk about here. So when I first met Haley, it was the freshman orientation, and we were doing a really big community service project. And so I saw this gal who looked like she was like just, you know, I didn't think that she was going to be super strong. I'll put it that way. And so we were out there ripping this boardwalk apart, and she was just ripping these boards off like it was just, you know, leaf paper. Like, she was just ripping them off. So I was like, well, she can do it, I can do it. So I went over there, and when I tell you, this board didn't budge. I couldn't get this thing to move. And so from the first time I met her, I knew there was something interesting about her. And so we decided to sit down and have this larger conversation. And Haley and I ended up becoming really, really close best friends. We lived together for a couple of years, and we still have stayed connected ever since that time. But if you look at the walks of life that Haley and I come from, we couldn't be any more different. And if I'd just seen her on the street in her lifted diesel truck doing a burnout down the road, I would have made a quick decision about that was based off of my own bias. You know, if we go back to this slide, that was related to safety, it was related to bias, it was related to my access to the experience that she was having, and it was due to an obstructed view of how I understood what she was doing, that would have limited my ability to form one of the best friendships that I have, right? So because I was able to kind of move some of those things off the table, Haley and I were able to connect in a really special way. And the same thing happened for her. We were able to have a lot of really deep conversations about her experience growing up in this rural area here, and hearing conversations about race and racism that really pointed fingers at a type of person that looked and functioned like her. And it made it really challenging for her to engage in this. And even though she didn't have malintention and she didn't want to perpetuate systems that felt challenging or didn't support people, she didn't know where to go, because a lot of the work that was being done built this archetype of a person that looked like Haley, and it didn't give her an opportunity to really step into a space to create a friendship with somebody who looked like me. So I share this story because I think it's really important to remember that some of this work can feel really like abstract, or it can feel like, well, what do I actually do with this? Or what could be the potential outcome of me listening to something underneath the surface? And some of that is that you can create spaces where friendships between somebody like me and like Haley can exist, because there's people who are modeling what it looks like to look beneath the surface and to really look for an opportunity to form a strong connection with someone based on who they truly are, not this perception of who we think they might be. So as you kind of move into these situations where you might be addressing a conversation about racism, I want you to kind of shift from this idea of somebody sharing to you that something might be racist and your response to them saying like, well, have you considered what it might look like from this other perception, to really start asking, what am I missing here? So if someone is sharing that something is troubling to them in their school experience, instead of thinking, well, have you considered the good things that are happening at school, or have you considered that there are people that do care about you here, I'm really asking yourself, what am I missing? Why is this a conversation that somebody wants to bring up? Why is this a topic that is impacting my students' ability to learn? And really challenging yourself to stay in that space and stay open to that learning. One of the tools that I found to be really helpful here is this is a seven-step program. So I did provide you a thing that you can copy and paste. And I don't know why the resolution of this photo looks so bad on my screen. I hope it looks better on yours. But something I want you to kind of consider is the seven steps. So the first one is preparing yourself for conversations. This is a huge step by itself. So at the beginning of this conversation about race and racism, I talked to you about how students know which buttons to press, right? And it's important for us to know and do our self-reflection and know what are some things that are hard for me to talk about? What are some things that are challenging? And how can I support myself ahead of time to be prepared for those conversations? Who am I going to need extra help from? What resources am I going to need to know that I have access to so that I can come back to them in a situation where I might not feel comfortable? What tie-ins from DPI do I need to know about so that when I'm building my curriculum, I know how to make sure that I'm teaching to the standards that are expected of me, right? So preparing yourself for the conversations is super important. The next one, which is also super helpful, is using Tell Me More. So if someone is expressing to you that they think something is racist, it's really great for that next question to be, can you tell me some more about that? When a student starts to disclose some of that information, a really great thing there is to find something to agree or connect with. So if a student is telling you, well, I think everything here is racist because nobody cares about me and this program is super dumb and I don't feel like I get to belong in anything, you don't have to say, like, you're right, everything here sucks. Way to go, kiddo. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm saying here is that this is an opportunity to practice empathy and say, like, yeah, that sounds like it would be super hard if you're coming to school every day and you feel like nobody cares about you, right? So it's that opportunity to value that a student is providing you with feedback and really, you know, give them that opportunity to feel seen. So that's what I'm talking about, and that find something to agree with space. The next one is that ask permission to share feedback. And so this is where it opens up to the two different types of scenarios we can have here. This is one where a student is expressing a need that is very true. They're suggesting that something is racist or something is wrong, and it is, right? So that's in that space for feedback where we can say, you know, I'm hearing what you're saying, and maybe I didn't see this before. I didn't know that this was happening until now. Can I follow up with you in this other way? Can I refer you to this other person? So that's an opportunity to really provide a pathway forward. If a student is using racist as a term just to try and, you know, seek some connection and find some attention from an adult, this is a great opportunity to offer that feedback and say, you know, it sounds like the thing that you're describing isn't actually racist. And it's really important to me that you know that that's not what this word means. And I'd be more than happy, again, to connect you with somebody else to kind of talk a little bit more about what that looks like. But in this classroom, we're not going to use that word to refer to things that it's not, right? Or in this space, we're not going to call something racist that it's not. And when you're doing that, it's really important to be the star performer that I know you know how to be. That's that speaking softer, slower, and lower, really modeling that self and co-regulation with students, taking a very visible or audible deep breath when you're processing something challenging can make a huge difference in your students' ability to share that space with you. The last support piece here is making sure to leave that door open to more conversations. So like when I was talking about my friend Haley, we don't want to create this archetype of what it means to be a certain kind of person that excludes our students from learning how to do something different. We want to make sure that we leave the door open so that they can continue to be curious and they can really explore these things that can be really challenging for adults and students to understand. So I created this poster in response to these questions that I'm going to provide to you all as staff, but you will see these up in our 7 through 12 buildings. So this poster format might look familiar to you if your building has a very similar one that talks about bullying. I thought that poster was brilliant. So what do? When we find brilliant things, we copy them. No, just kidding. But, like, actually, it was a great idea. So why reinvent the wheel, right? Like, this is a really great way to kind of break this down. So, again, when we find a situation where someone might be accusing something of being racist, this is a great way to kind of check in and see what is really happening here. Are we talking about conflict, like a disagreement or a difference? Like, just because we might have a different race, we can still have conflict? That isn't racist, right? We can disagree, but that doesn't mean that it's racist. It means that it's conflict. when someone treats others unfairly or values others based on their race, skin color, gender, body size, or other parts of who they are unintentionally, that's when we're talking about unconscious bias. So that's where we don't really know that we're making that mistake, right? So that's that difference between intent and impact. Our intent was not to intentionally value someone or unfairly value someone, but that is the impact that we're having there. So making sure that there's that difference in that unintentional and intentional space. When we move to this next one, that's when we're talking about prejudice. So when someone treats others unfairly or values others based on their race, skin color, gender, body size, or other parts of who they are intentionally. So that's hurting somebody's feelings on purpose, right? So that's when we're talking about prejudice. So that's a strategic pattern that somebody might be participating in. The last one here is when we're talking about someone who treats others unfairly or values others based more on their race or skin color, and that person has more power to influence the situation. That's when we're talking about racism. When we look at APA's definition of racism, it ties in the four eyes of oppression, which are institutional, internalized, interpersonal, and ideological. So when we're talking about racism, it can show up in all of those four ways. So we can look at a systems approach. So if you pull back to 2 hours ago when I was talking to you about data in the state of Wisconsin and how we consistently show up across our state underserving a specific demographic, that's looking at a system approach of how racism has interacted with our ability to work as a community. Then if we look at interpersonal spaces, so that's when we're talking to one another, and that's where I might be demonstrating my prejudice of treating people unfairly based off of their race, that's when I'm showing up and doing things that are racist, right? If I'm calling people names that are explicitly racist, if I'm excluding people from sitting with me at lunch because of how they work, based off of their race, right? That is what I'm talking about, a racist act. So I think this is a really important chart here just to kind of break down what those differences look like. I don't think that every conversation you have with a kid moving forward is like, well, actually, this is unconscious bias. You don't need to use this language with all of our kids because it's not really accessible for everybody yet, right? But I think it's important for us on this side of the table as the teachers and the leaders in this space to have access to this language so we can start to kind of lead a conversation with students that provides them with these tools to build their own understandings of the world around them and use it to create the space that they would like to be in. So making sure that they have that access is a great way that we can make sure that they can do, you know, the best that they can do in that space. So, holy moly, did I share a lot of information with you all today. Thank you so much for staying engaged and making sure that there are things in the chat. I've seen lots of great messages you all have sent me. We have 3 minutes left today, so I am going to provide you with some time to ask me some questions, but while I do that, I'm going to drop you my link to my exit survey. Because that's going to be really important for me. So remember that in this forum, there is a place for you to share what kind of presentations, trainings, resources that you need more access to so that you can do your job best. I really need your feedback there so that I can make sure to provide something that's relevant, because I don't want to put you in a situation where you have to listen to something that isn't actually going to apply to what you're going to do in your classroom. So please just take some time for that. So I see some questions just about what's going to be made available to you. So in an hour, I'm going to be doing this presentation again, and then an hour after that, I'm doing it again. So I'm not going to send you all of these slides today because I'm just going to be talking all day. But tomorrow morning, you can watch for an email that's either going to come from me or your building leader that will include a link to all of the slides that I shared with you today, as well as a link to where all of that information is going to be stored in Schoology, as well as Google, so that you'll have access to all of this. So just stay on the lookout for that. The question in here about permission, I don't have a good answer for that right now, but I'm copying this question and saving it so that I can make sure I ask somebody who will be able to answer it better than me.